Hello and welcome to this week's Convex Conversation with me, broadcaster Helen Fospero. Today's guest started her career as a PE teacher in a secondary school and didn't take the typical sailing route at all. Yet Dee Kafari has become a record-breaking yachtswoman, tackling 12-metre-high waves, cyclones and storms, experiencing extreme sleep deprivation and physical hardships of the kind most of us mere mortals can't even imagine. Dee has sailed around the world not once, but six times, and has earned her place in the history books. She's the first woman to have done it single-handed in both directions, and the only woman to have circumnavigated the globe non-stop a total of three times. In 2006, Dee became the first woman to do it the wrong way, i.e. against prevailing winds and currents, and was awarded the MBE in recognition of her extraordinary achievement. Dee, I'm just laughing as I read this because I am in absolute awe of what you've accomplished. I've got so many questions to ask her about your adventures, but I mean, that's quite an intro, isn't it?
It is. Even I'm impressed listening to it. Who is this lady? And then I have a realization that it's actually me. Yeah, I've managed to fit quite a lot into a very short space of time when you consider that I was a school teacher for 5 years.
That's amazing. Do you pinch yourself sometimes when you hear an introduction like that and think, gosh, that really is quite amazing?
Yes, and it's actually good to be reminded of it sometimes because we all get caught up in our everyday trials and tribulations, and it's easy to forget some of the achievements that you've done. And yes, mine happened to be multiple around the world, but everyone's got their own version of around the world within them that they've achieved. And I think it is quite good to have a time where you get to pat yourself on the back and remind yourself that you've done some good things.
Well, you should give yourself a big pat on the back today. I'm certainly very impressed. And I think I was thinking for a long time about where we actually start. But I suppose what I'd like to know, first of all, is how did a secondary school PE teacher end up becoming a record-breaking sailor?
Yeah, I couldn't have foreseen it. And I laugh now when I go back into schools and I talk to the children about aspirations, inspiring them to push their boundaries, take on challenges, that I had no concept of the world of sailing that was out there or opportunities that may have arisen when I was their age at school. I was still confused, not really sure what direction I was going to go in, had lots of interest, but I was distracted so easily. And it was actually a conversation that I had with my father just before he passed away. I was always that person that would see something on TV or see someone else, read someone else's story and go, oh, that looks good, I'd like to do that. And he said, well, are you going to do any of these things or are you just going to talk about it? And I think that was the penny that dropped then of actually life is quite a precious resource and you have to actually go and make it happen sometimes. And I think his passing kind of just made me dwell on that conversation we had and put into action some of my hopes and dreams and crazy ideas and to see what I could do.
And often athletes and great sports people started their sport, you know, they have stories of starting when they were 2 or 3 years old. But I gather your passion for sailing didn't really happen until university days.
That's true. My father had a motorboat, so we kind of used it like a caravan on water at weekends, at holidays. And so my seamanship and awareness skills probably came from him from a young age. But I'd never actually sailed until I went to university, as you say. And I went to Leeds, landlocked Leeds, so it confuses people even more. But I majored in outdoor education and we had access to a lot of activities. And we went off to the west coast of Scotland and went sailing. And I fell in love with it. And then I kind of used my free time and my spare time to expand my knowledge and my skills. And it was always kind of rumbling away in the background. Although I have to say when I was teaching, I absolutely loved what I did and still something I'm quite proud that I went through and, you know, I admire teachers and to inspire the next generation is something that I've managed to kind of link into my sailing career as well now.
Well, I suppose you're still able to do that by talking to youngsters about the journey that you've been on in life.
That's right, because, you know, there's that massive pressure for them at school to have an idea of where they want to go. And what they don't realise is actually life is about opportunities and the big decisions are which ones to grab and which ones to let you pass you by. And it's okay these days to change careers or change direction, whereas I think historically we had a very traditional route of a career that lasts a lifetime. And I think that's, you know, totally blown out the window for most people now.
So it's one thing, isn't it, Dee, you know, falling in love with sailing and enjoying it in Scotland in university days. Where did that go from your father's sort of wise words asking if you were going to sort of realise some of these dreams you had? How did you turn sailing as a hobby, if you like, into dreams and achievements? What was the tipping point, I suppose, is what I'm trying to ask, that made you leave teaching and absolutely go for it?
I think I was at a stage where life was very comfortable. It was really good. But if I didn't go and do it then, I maybe would have had more responsibilities and changing a career wouldn't have been as smooth or as easy. So I think I took my opportunity with the timing. And then I had to accept that I was starting at the bottom of the pile and getting the qualifications. And then I had to get experience. Because a piece of paper is one thing, but until you've gone and actually experienced what it's like, it means nothing. I think it's, you can imagine like qualifying as a medical doctor and then suddenly being thrust into multiple surgeries. You kind of hone your craft as you get more experience at it. And I think that for me then opened up this new world of opportunities and possibilities that I probably didn't even know existed. I had a fairy tale idea of what a career in the maritime industry might look like, but it's a discipline of sport that has so many different sections to it that actually it's a whole new world that you have to choose which route you want to take. And it's, you know, exciting because they're not all the same.
And what was the first major opportunity that you got sort of once you left teaching?
It was interesting. I went and retrained at UKSA on the Isle of Wight. So I went and did all the water sports that you could possibly do. But obviously, having been a teacher for 5 years, I was a little bit older than some of the others. And I thought, well, you know, am I going to walk along the beach and kind of teach people canoeing and kayaking and that kind of thing? Or, you know, there's this whole new world of yachts that I don't know much about. And I went offshore on a boat and, you know, kind of cemented the fact that I knew I was interested, but actually I genuinely love being out there. That whole harnessing the power of nature and no 2 days ever being the same. And I thought, yeah, this is the environment I'd like to be in. And then I learned about a whole new world of racing around the world. That was an opportunity that someone like me could do, which I just thought was incredible. And I was very lucky to sail for Mike Golding in my first job, a British sailor that had multiple round the worlds and had been hugely successful. And I kind of saw what this world was like. And I had an opportunity with Sir Robin Knox-Johnson to go sailing. And he manages the Clipper race that takes amateurs around the world. And he said to me, don't be that person that stands in the bar and says, oh, well, I could have, or I should have, or I would have, but you didn't. And I thought, oh, you know, that's another kind of nugget, a gem of information of don't be that person that lets an opportunity pass you by. And then eventually the Global Challenge came along, Sir Che Blyth's race that takes amateur crew around the world with a professional skipper against the prevailing winds and currents. And that was the timing that worked for me where I felt ready to take on something that big. And that was my first round the world. And then from then on, it's kind of snowballed.
I know that your first round the world was the Ocean Race. Was that the one, were you skipper on that one or were you in the team the first time you did it?
So the first time I went round the world was Sir Che Blyth's Global Challenge. So I was a skipper on board. There were 12 identical boats with 12 professional skippers. And we had 17 amateur paying crew for the adventure of a lifetime. So it starts off as a sailing exercise because you've got all different levels of experience and ability and ages and interest, and they're all there for 17 different reasons. So you're trying to marry up this connection. And as you go around the world, that changes to more of a man management exercise and a conflict management exercise. You can imagine everybody living within this 72-foot world, this steel tank that gets hot and cold and goes through good times and bad times. It's an emotional roller coaster. And I learned not only a lot about them and sailing around the world and managing that, but also a lot about myself at that time. But you could argue that's probably what led to me doing that same trip without the 17 people on board.
Yeah, do you think I could do this without them? I have a lot more space and thinking time for myself. So I'm going to leap ahead a bit because I was going to ask you about skippering a bit later, but it seems sort of the right time now. I mean, what sort of skipper are you, Dee? And obviously you were with a team who weren't all as experienced as you. So I'd imagine that's quite different to skippering a team who are very experienced.
Yes, and I've had the experience of doing both now. So my most recent round the world was skipper of Turn the Tide in the Ocean Race with a professional crew, but I took on a mixed crew, so five girls, five guys that hadn't been done before. and 80% of my crew were under 30, so they hadn't sailed around the world before. They were exceedingly highly skilled sailors, but they'd never done the race around the world that lasts for 10 months and that kind of intensity. So it was a really big challenge to take on. But the skills I learned from leading the amateur crew were transferable to this. I'm a pretty easygoing leader. I mean, I'd much rather, you know, kind of be happy and fluffy rather than the hard taskmaster. But for me, I've learned that it's about empowering the people around you. You get these people because they're good at what they do. So let them be good at what they do. And they just need nurturing and guiding and nudging and encouraging. And actually building their confidence to take on ownership and responsibility. And by doing that, I had complete buy-in. They were fully kind of immersed in the project. They felt they were contributing and they felt that they were being listened to. And it was interesting because we had 10 nationalities. So that was quite a learning curve for me to manage all those emotions. But it was something that I've really now seen. You see people grow before your eyes and you just want to empower that so that they grow, you know, as we went. So the team I finished with after 10 months was not the same team that I started with at all. And that was an amazing journey to go on and be part of that facilitation of these people growing and learning and developing in their experience.
That must have been hugely rewarding. And what did you learn about yourself on that first experience as a skipper?
Well, the first one was hard. It was quite an emotional roller coaster because I didn't anticipate the issues that I had. That learning curve actually helped me in subsequent round the worlds. That realization of it's lonely at the top and you're at the top because you've got the difficult decisions to make and you're not going to keep everybody happy with some of those decisions that you're going to make. And that leadership role is you're not there to be friends with everybody. You're there that when it all goes wrong, the buck stops with you. You have that level of responsibility and how you develop them affects that atmosphere, then that environment that you've created as a leader. And that was a massive learning curve for me. And I struggled with that initially, but I've now learned that it is a lonely place and you do have some difficult decisions. But if you are transparent and open in your communication, people actually come with you on this journey and they all work together in the same direction to help success because they're all part of the project. And I think that's really important that that communication is key in a team.
And of course, there's no escape, is there? You're in a very small space and you're there for the 10 months. There's no sort of hopping off and changing your mind. So I would imagine those leadership skills, you know, that makes it even more difficult that you are with each other 24/7 and through some very difficult and presumably frightening times, you know, depending on the weather.
Exactly. And some of those times are actually life and death. You're making critical decisions for the safety of your crew and the vessel. And it's interesting, I speak a lot to businesses about leadership and teamwork, but actually at the end of the day, they all get to leave, walk out the door and leave each other, go home, kind of digest what's happened on the day or go to the gym or work out any frustrations or just spend time with their family and come back refreshed the next morning. And we just don't have that ability. We are literally, there's nowhere to go. And even if you're in your bunk, you try and give somebody the space if they're in their bunk that it's their space and time. But they might get woken up for a sail change, or you might do a manoeuvre, or you might have to need an extra pair of hands. And everybody has good days and bad days at different times. And people are going to struggle with the fatigue and the weariness, even the conditions that you're in with the extreme heat or the extreme cold. So it's just being empathetic to all the characters in your team and putting the right people in the right roles and getting the best out of them. But it's been a huge learning curve for me, and it's transferable skills that I now can feel very empowered to help others with when they're in a leadership role or a team environment.
When you look back at that particular trip, what was the most difficult time, the sort of most challenging conditions you faced, and what was the most breathtaking and amazing part of that trip?
I think it doesn't matter which round the world you think about, those moments are so close together. And it's often in the Southern Ocean, the most remote part of the planet. We talk about Point Nemo, which is the furthest point from land you can get in the South Pacific. The closest person to you at that point is in the International Space Station. So it just kind of gives you some perspective on how irrelevant you are. And you think you're in a big boat with lots of people and, you know, you're this tiny, irrelevant piece on the whole planet. And at that time in the Southern Ocean, you've got extreme conditions and it can be super windy, really rough, big waves, and the storms are battering you, the freezing water, the freezing wind, the conditions, everything's working against you. But it can also be some of the absolute best sailing you can ever do. and you feel so privileged to be down there because not everybody gets to go down there. There isn't shipping routes, it's not busy area. Very few of us have gone down to the Southern Ocean and sailed in the Southern Ocean. And the waves are big, but they're long and the boat's accelerating and it just feels magical. And the albatross come and they just soar above the waves. And we always talk about them keeping an eye on us. They're the spirits and the souls of the sailors of the sea. It's that kind of just magical moment. You've got a 360 degree horizon. You're in nature's element and you feel quite privileged to be there.
So what made you want to get rid of the 17 and do it by yourself?
It's funny. At the time, it was the leg from Cape Town to Boston. We'd just had dinner in Cape Town with Sir Che Blythe, all the skippers, and he said, oh, you all need to be thinking about what's next. This is a stepping stone for your career. And all of us were just thinking, how on earth do we get to the end? Let's take one step at a time. And he spoke to me. I was the only female skipper in the lineup, which that was in 2004, and not a lot's changed because in the most recent race I did, I was still the only female skipper in the lineup. Our sport is changing slowly, shall we say. And he said, it's only a matter of time before a female will follow in my footsteps. So he just planted this seed. He did the Impossible Voyage back in 75. And it was called the Impossible Voyage because he sailed over the horizon and nobody really knew if he was going to come back. And almost a year later, 300 and something days later, he did, having sailed against the prevailing winds and currents. So this seed had been planted and we left Cape Town and we sailed 7,000 miles to Boston. So I've got my crew. Geographically, we crossed the outgoing track. So they were really happy they'd physically circumnavigated the globe. They'd survived the Southern Ocean. And so they're confident. They've learned a lot. They're happy. And they start to question your decisions, rightly so. And as you get to the centre of the Atlantic, you get to the doldrums where it's hot. There's very little wind or there's thunderstorms and the boat's very slow. And it's really hard work and very frustrating. And at that time, I kind of thought to myself that it might be easier without the 17 people to manage on board. And by the time I got to Boston, I had the conversation with Che and I said, so what do I need to do to sail around the world without 17 other people on board? And that then led to the next leg into Europe from America. We went across the Atlantic and I was looking at the boat all the time thinking, well, what would I need to change? We finished the race in July of that year and I left again on the exact same boat without the 17 people in November of the same year with some changes that I had planned on, you know, all on my own. And that initial few days, I spent a lot of time looking for the other 17 people that were going to help me do things and realising that I'd taken this on and I was on my own.
When you've got a crew of 17, I mean, I presume there are many moments when you're sailing around the world that you're all busy and you've all got things to do. So it's all down to you. I can't really imagine what this is like, but lots of questions sort of come to mind. I mean, first of all, how do you cope with the solitude for such a long time?
Initially, that's what I found very difficult on that initial round the world on my own. I had to learn how to live with myself 24 hours a day, and it's not as easy as you think. I was having this huge highs and lows. I was laughing and loving it and smiling and frustrated I couldn't share it with anybody. And equally, I'd be crying and be really emotional and not really understand why. And one of the transitions I made from that initial solo around the world to the next one, which was the Vendée Globe, was I saw a sports psychologist. And actually, I learned to understand and manage myself. And understanding the impact of hydration and nutrition on your emotional state. So now I can pretty much guarantee I'll go around the world very level with my emotions, not these highs and lows. I probably won't cry about it. And I'm very confident I can manage myself. But initially, that first round the world, I was all over the shop. And that kind of 24 hours a day with yourself for 178 days was a pretty long time.
And how do you manage to sleep or sleep? Very much. I presume that you are functioning on sleep deprivation for much of the trip.
You are, but it is impressive how your body adapts. And I can only liken it to parents of young children. So initially, before you have a child, you're happily sleeping through the night and you don't get disturbed. And then suddenly you have this innate ability to be able to hear your baby rustle or turn over or gurgle or make the slightest sound. And that goes on for 21 years when you're listening for them to come in the front door and close it behind them and tell you what time they came in the next morning.
So right.
So, you know, I don't have children, but it's this very similar thing that when you're on a boat, you're almost just resting and you're listening to the noises and you know what the normal noises are. And the minute one of those noises changes, you know what it is and you know that you have to get up and do something. Because it's your life in your hands, you can't just roll over and hope someone else will deal with it because there's no one else there. And so your sleep pattern is more cat naps of 10 minutes, 20 minutes. And a long sleep for me was an hour and a half. But sometimes you can get up and check everything and go back to sleep again. It really just depends on where you are geographically and what hazards are around you and what the weather's doing as well. There's always something to do. Everyone says, don't you suffer, but it takes your body probably about 7 to 10 days to adapt. And then you just get used to this cycle. And I was probably averaging around 5 hours sleep in a 24-hour period and managing fine. The transition that was hard was coming back to everyday life where people expected me to sleep all night and then be awake all day. That's where I struggled.
And how do you manage physically all the different jobs that you need to do when you're sailing? Because presumably if you're up the mast doing something, you can't be somewhere else. What are the challenges like that in terms of the fact that it's just you and there's nobody else to do something for you at the same time?
Everything is broken down and has a process. It's all about step-by-step processes. So if you think about watching a boat with a full crew, everybody's doing stuff simultaneously because every job affects everybody else's and everything happens at the same time and the manoeuvre happens. When you're on your own, you want to achieve the same, but you have to prioritise and order everything so that you're very methodical in your process and it always happens the same way each time so that you can manage everything. It is surprising how achievable it is. And with the physicality out there, it is very physical sometimes, and the females are never going to be as physical as the guys. But what you can do is you can have this ability to just sail a little clever for your physicality personally. So the guys might do a sail change a little bit later than the girls maybe because, you know, they've got the guts and the brute force to deal with it. Whereas we just need to be a little bit clever. And it just goes to show that it's a very level playing field out there. Mother Nature is very leveling for everybody. And we're on the same boats in the same bit of water doing exactly the same job. So it's one of those unique sports where it really has a level playing field. And that's why I like it as well.
And when you're so far away from home and normal life and you are that tiny little dot in the sea, but this time you are that tiny little dot in the sea without 17 other people around you, you know, are there moments when you're frightened? Are there moments when you worry whether you'll survive bad weather? Or, you know, I imagine mentally it must be a great strain at times, I would have thought.
I think you have to be very specific with where you allow your fear to go. So you have absolute trust in your equipment. You spend a lot of time building that trust in your preparation, building your intuition, your instinctive seamanship so that you make the right decisions and you're considered in your approach so that you know when to push and you know when to hold back a little bit. And that's the balance. That's where people are very clever at getting consistency. You're not going for the peak speeds. You're trying to be consistently performing all the time so that overall you end up with a good performance. And I think the fear factor comes from experience. So when you go into your first storm, it's adrenaline fueled, you're very, very busy, and you come out the other side of it and you almost in relief, you're like, whoa, that was super scary. And, you know, I could cry now, or I'll feel better if I have a good cry, or finally I'm going to eat something, or I haven't slept for a day. And then the next one you go into, you think, well, that isn't as bad as last time. And the wind isn't quite so strong. And well, we did this last time, but I remember to do that this time. So every kind of experience you have helps build this confidence that you have. And it allows you to just do a better job of it next time. And I think that's why we keep going back to sea, because we know we can do it a little bit better next time because we've learned from our mistakes before, which is probably why, you know, I've got that drive to keep going out there, because you'd think six times would be enough. But if someone phoned up, I'd love to go again.
I'd love to go again. I'd like to come with you this time. I can't sail, by the way. I don't think a bit of sunseekers in Turkey counts, really, does it? I don't think I'd be much use to you. But there must have been some really beautiful moments as well. I mean, you are seeing parts of the world that most of us will never see. Are there some real standout moments where you think, oh my goodness, how lucky am I to be here or to witness this or to see that? I just wonder what stands out from that particular first solo trip.
Absolutely. That whole feeling so privileged to be at one with nature in its own environment. And I think the fact that you don't have any ambient light, so that whole Milky Way view above you is almost all yours. You're feeling like you're getting a private showing. That first time that the dolphins come and play in the bow wave and kind of come and say hello to you, and you get that reassurance that, oh, they're looking after me, this is okay. That first time that you see a water spout and you see a whale's tail breach and you just think, oh God, that's huge. You know, these are huge mammals and I'm in their world. And then equally, you're in the most hostile ocean in the world and you see these incredible birds that effortlessly glide over these huge waves and you just think, God, they are just happy. This is their home. This is incredible. And you feel very lucky to experience that stuff. And the endless horizons, the sunsets, the sunrises, and the video and the photos really do it justice. So you have that kind of snapshot in your mind that you keep with you, and you realize that you're very lucky to go and see that type of thing and to experience what you do. Because the reason we love sailing is no 2 days are ever the same. It's a very complex sport because it doesn't have a fixed pitch. It's changing all the time, be it the wind, the currents, the waves. So it's challenging you all the time. And every time you think you've got it sussed, you know, a little curveball will come in and throw something else different at you. And that's why we're always constantly growing and learning every time we're out on the water.
You've got such a lovely smile, Dee, and really sparkly eyes when you talk about sailing and your adventures. And just getting to know you briefly on this podcast, when you've been away for 178 or so days, do you chat everybody's head off when you get back?
It's so funny you ask, because I am awful for that. As you can tell, I am quite a sociable person. And that initial solo voyage where I was at sea for 178 days, when I crossed the finish line, the initial four people came on board and they were actually quite nervous that, oh, what's she going to be like? She's been on her own for 178 days. Will she have changed?
Has she gone feral?
There was a little bit of apprehension. What they weren't prepared for was the fact that by then I didn't really need sleep and I was so excited, but I literally wanted to talk to them constantly, nonstop. They took their own watch system just to listen to me. I think their ears were bleeding. And I took them on a day by day journey of my 178 days of everything I did, everything I fixed. Look at this. And then I did this. And it was hilarious. And the interesting thing was I initially crossed that finish line at the Lizard Lighthouse in Cornwall. And then I had to officially arrive at a set time into Southampton and Princess Anne was meeting me. So I had that a little bit of time from Thursday to Sunday just to fill. And I think it was a good thing because I allowed me to get all this conversation out that I hadn't had with anybody, because I'd hadn't interacted facially with anybody. And I found their jokes hilariously funny. They're not that funny, but I thought it was because I hadn't genuinely laughed with anybody for so long. It allowed me to get all this out of my system so that when I officially arrived for Princess Anne and my family, I was relatively normal by then.
I love the fact that some people call it the wrong way around the world, because I'm sure when you're doing school speeches, children say, must think, you know, oh, wonder why she took a wrong turn. And the reason that makes me laugh is I headed to the Isle of Wight last week from London and ended up in the Cotswolds. Thanks to Waze. So what does the wrong way actually mean?
Not relying on a sat nav, clearly, from your Cotswold experience. The wrong way. So as you go down the Atlantic, you head south, and when you get to the bottom, the wrong way is to turn right. So you go under Cape Horn, South America first. And that means that you're ending up going upwind. So everything, the currents, due to the way the earth spins, the currents and the winds are working against you all the time. So if you were to stop and do nothing, you'd end up going backwards. And because it's upwind, that's the only direction a boat can't sail. So you have to zigzag your way. So you spend a lot of time sailing in what's considered the wrong direction, which is very demoralizing. You do a lot of extra distance and it takes a lot of extra time. So 6 months around the world, what's considered the wrong way compared to under 3 months to go the right way. So when you go down the right way, when I did the Vendée Globe, I had a bit of a reputation by then and I headed down the Atlantic. And Michel Desjoyeaux, the French skipper who went on to win that edition of the Vendée Globe, he sent me an email. And he said, don't forget to turn left. I was just super excited he knew who I was. But then I laughed that my reputation had preceded me and he wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to go upwind around the world again and that I could actually turn left and enjoy the surf and the speed that everybody else does when they go around the world. And I did the wrong way first, and I'm glad because now I've experienced how enjoyable it is to go at speed where everything's helping you and it's exciting and fast. I don't think I'd ever go the wrong way again.
No, and more people I read have walked on the moon than have successfully completed a westabout circumnavigation, she says, trying to use some proper lingo. So I can see why you actually took that on first, because I think it'd be demoralising to do that after you've gone the right way. So you would do it again, dear? I mean, if the right opportunity came up now, you do fancy it again?
I genuinely love being out on the water. I love being on the oceans. I love all the sailing around the world that I've done. And I feel I'm getting more experience and I can push harder and I'm getting a better sailor all the time. So if an opportunity came up, I would, you know, jump at it because I genuinely love being out there. In the meantime, while there's not a round the world going on, I'm doing a lot of coastal racing double-handed because due to the new COVID world, double-handed is a really safe way to sail. And that's going to be a new class in the Olympics in 2024. So I'm kind of dabbling around to see if I've got a future as an Olympian, mixing my two passions of racing and sailing.
Fantastic. Do you think you'll go for the Olympics in 2024?
Well, it's a long way away and there's a lot of very good sailors out there, but I am loving the double-handed sailing that we're doing. And we seem to be doing quite well at the moment. So let's hope that this road continues.
I mean, many of your achievements that we detailed in the introduction have been alone, but, you know, we also touched on the fact that you're a well-respected skipper. What was it like skippering the ocean race? Because that's different, isn't it, to skippering when you've got a more inexperienced crew with you?
Most definitely. And the biggest difference to me was the professional environment that I was in. And I felt almost a little out of my depth. Had that little bit of, oh, can I do this? Have I got the skills to get my team and be competitive? And it's the intensity as well. So as a race around the world, it lasts for 10 months. And there isn't really a sporting race or an event like that that lasts for so long at that intensity. You've got to have that ability when the results haven't gone your way to pick your team back up and get back out there on the next leg and go for it again. And that takes some real depth of character to find that voice that says the right things and build your team back up and takes them with you on the journey.
And you've talked a little bit in previous interviews about maybe feeling like you suffer a little bit with imposter syndrome. Would those be the situations that's when you perhaps felt like that?
Yes, and I think it's that realisation when you sit in a room with the other skippers, and these are names that you've read about, you've seen on interviews, you've seen pictures of, and here you are sat next to them, and you think, have I got what it takes to compete with them, or can I justify being sat here next to them? And I think it's just that realisation of having that self-belief and that confidence that you've earned your place to get there and you do deserve to be there. But it's just the idea of these people are the people that you've read about and seen and they're really good and suddenly you're in that environment with them.
And because you're humble about what you do, I suppose you're not taking into account that they've obviously read about you as well. But I don't think you're the sort of person that would think about that kind of thing. You strike me as the type of person that gets your head down and gets on with the job in hand and makes things happen. So I sort of can understand why you'd feel like that, although I'm sure not rightly so. I know as well you're passionate about the health of our oceans and being out there on your own round the world. What is it like? What do you see physically in our oceans that's troubling and worrying? And what can we do? Is it too late to repair some of the damage that's been done?
Well, I'm definitely a glass half full person. So I really, really believe that it's never too late to do something and make change happen. So when I first went around the world, you see a lot of plastic in the ocean. So you see crates and fishing nets, food packaging, bottles, balloons, helium balloons are the worst. And you see this stuff. And I was thinking, am I seeing it now because we're talking about ocean health, or is it actually getting worse? So the most recent round the world voyage, having the young crew on board sailing around the world for the first time, it was really interesting to see their reaction. And it just confirmed to me that actually I do think it's getting worse, because they were seeing it and commentating on it and kind of were devastated by what they were seeing. I was reassured that it wasn't just me making the issue bigger because now I'm more aware of it. It actually is a problem. And it was incredible what we did see. But we also did a lot of science as we went round, and we were testing the water for microplastics. And that's the bit that really hit home, that even in the Southern Ocean, when we were at Point Nemo, that place that's the most remote place on the Earth that we spoke about, there were still microplastics present. And you're thinking, how on earth? You know, no one's down here. It's not like you're seeing all the macro plastics, the big stuff floating around. But that realization that that big stuff that you do see in the busy places in the Atlantic are being broken down by the sun and the waves, and these microplastics are then just circulating on the ocean's currents, getting confused for food, getting into the food chain. And I think when you can say to people, so you're now eating it, it suddenly brings it to a personal level. And I think people are starting to understand it, one, because they interact with plastic every day and they now can make informed choices. But two, because when you say, oh, you're having fish and chips, that's nice, I wonder how much plastic's in your fish, they suddenly realise that this is having an effect that's personal to them. And I think until people really identify with it on a personal level, people won't make changes. So I think it's really important.
And as chair of the World Sailing Trust, presumably that's part of that job as well, is it to raise awareness and encourage people to do more to reduce their plastic?
Exactly. The World Sailing Trust is really to look at two aspects of environment and people. So we want the sport of sailing to embrace the environment that it is privileged to use and look after it and nurture it and be stewards for its future, but also look after the people and ensure the sustainability of our sport, as in the succession and the next generation and future sailors, be inclusive, be diverse and grow our sport that way. So it's a pretty big task for the charity of World Sailing, but I believe we've got the reach, and everybody that does interact with the sea or the rivers or the beaches can actually have a personal connection and understand what we're saying.
Do you still eat fish, Dee? Does it worry you that there is so much plastic in our food chain?
I do still eat fish, and I probably eat less red meat now because of that usage of the land and the water. But I do still eat fish. It's a health decision, and I'm not extreme to go completely vegetarian or vegan, but I do make some really good choices now, and I have changed a lot of habits that I had to the better habit as far as consuming and using less plastic. So I'm quite conscientious in my personal environmental footprint and making informed decisions where I can.
Yeah, no, same goes for me, really. I mean, we were introduced before we did this podcast by a mutual friend of ours, Nick Hopkinson, who has had the privilege of sailing with you, he tells me, and loved every minute of it. But he also said, before I let you go, to ask you about the African painted wolves and the teacup.
Hoppy is just such a wonderful character. And actually, if you want to be inspired by how much food affects you personally, he's the perfect person for that. But he did our inspirational talk each day as our team before we went sailing, just to kind of rev us all up. And it was all about the African painted wolves being a pack and only being as good as the wolf next to you. There wasn't a leader that left everyone behind. They do everything together and you have each other's backs, which is perfect for sailing because you can't actually do anything without everybody being involved and contributing to the objective and goal. And they had these amazing cups done with the African painted wolf as the prize at the end of the week for the sailor, the team player of the week.
Oh, what a lovely thing to do. Dee, we wish you the best of luck with your future adventures. I mean, it really has been great to step into your world and get a little bit of sense of what it's like. And it's so different to the vast majority of ours. So thanks for sharing it. And I do hope you enjoy the sailing that you're doing now and that we might see you in the 2024 Olympics.
Well, fingers crossed, but it's been lovely to talk to you and share some of my salty sea dog stories with you and kind of give people an idea of what it's like out there in the middle of the world's oceans.
You've got to dare to dream as well, haven't you, Dee? I know you're a big believer in that.
Definitely. Don't be afraid. You can always do more than you think you can.
You've been listening to record-breaking yachtswoman and adventurer Dee Kafari, MBE. Dare to Dream, says Dee. I don't know about you, but she's left me feeling really inspired and motivated, and also inspired by the words of her dad as well, that you've got to get out there and just make those things happen. There's no point talking about it. Thanks for listening to Dee's story. We love it when you share the podcast with friends and family, so do pass on the link, convex.podbean.com, or let people know about the Convex Conversation. It's easily found on Spotify, Google and Apple Podcasts. See you next week. Bye for now.